Episode of the Baptist Biased. I'm your host, Pastor Shelley, and we have a special guest that's going to come on this afternoon. It's Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and we're really excited to have him come on and talk about a new movie he's about to have released, Protocol 7. We're going to go ahead and join him now. Dr. Wakefield, it's great to have you here on the show.
Jonathan, thank you so much for having me on.
And I want to make sure we're getting you up there on the screen. Maybe, I don't know. There we go. Sorry about that. So thanks so much for joining us. And you have a new movie coming out, Protocol 7. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this film?
Certainly. Well, as a physician and someone who'd been involved in the vaccine safety research and the failings of the pharmaceutical industry and the regulators over many years, people would come to me because of the position I'd taken from the CDC, from the FDA, from the Department of Health in England, or from the industry, and they would say, "We have done a terrible thing. We can no longer live with this, and here is the evidence." And so I became a repository for whistleblowers, at least some whistleblowers. And these, I would, at the time when I was still practicing, I would pass these on to lawyers to be dealt with according to their merits. But they would make amazing stories. And one of the things that struck me over the years is that there was no accountability, none at all. That people would could do the most egregious things and they would just move on to another job, and the public, in particularly this case, the children would be left to, the damaged children would be left to pick up the pieces. And that was not good enough. And so with this film, it was a story in that mode. It was a whistleblower who came to me many years ago and told me the most extraordinary story of fraud at Merck in relation to the mumps vaccine as part of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And I decided that it was time to make a film to tell the world, because this case would be likely in some way to settle without anyone hearing about it, with three lines at page five of the New York Times, and no one would be aware of what happened in the interests of profit, and certainly not in the interests of the children. And therefore, we had to move forward, take a risk, if you like. And the unique thing about this film, Jonathan, unless someone corrects me otherwise, is that the majority of films like this that are made, whistleblower stories like Erin Brockovich's, the crime is committed, the court case resolves, the book is written, and the movie's made. This film is being released right in the heat of battle, right in the middle of the litigation, which is currently taking place in Pennsylvania. So, a very exciting story, and one which I would absolutely compel your listeners to go and watch, because it really will change their lives and their understanding of what is going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. I'm kind of curious when you talked about this whistleblower coming to you, what year is this, or what was the timeline when they
This is
approached
back
you?
in about 2003 or 4. I mean, a long time ago,
Okay, wow, yeah, that
soon
is a long
after.
time ago.
And it is, and they've done everything they can to delay the case and to string it out and to take it out of the public consciousness. And I just decided enough was enough. The same faulty vaccine is being used, the same vaccine which they fraudulently misrepresented is still being used. And the people who are paying the price for this, that is the children who are receiving this vaccine, are not getting any kind of justice. And that's unacceptable.
Well, and it's kind of a shame that a film like this, it's very difficult to share the information about it. It's not like mainstream media is probably blasting your film right now. I'm sure it's something where you kind of have to send it out on maybe alternative media or alternative news and talk to different individuals and kind of raise awareness for the film itself. Have you seen any major publications promoting your film or even talking about it?
No, but it's a very, very interesting. Years ago, I released Vaxxed, and I don't know whether your viewers remember, Vaxxed was about a fraud at the CDC in respect of MMR. And it got into Tribeca Film Festival, which is a very eminent film festival, and then it was banned, it was withdrawn, it was censored, and Robert De Niro disapproved of this, and he went on to the Good Morning America and the Today Show the following week to talk about Tribeca, and all he spoke about was the film that didn't play, Vax, and he said that we shouldn't have done that, we should not have censored this film, everybody should see it, and it exploded worldwide. So I think that they've learned their lesson from that, and they're maintaining a very low profile. But certainly the influence of pharma upon mainstream media is considerable. Indeed, the nightly news networks would not exist without the pharmaceutical industry in its current form. So it is going to get out there, not least of which is through shows like yours, as part of the alternative media, if you like, which actually do reach people now. People do listen in very large numbers and are increasingly shunning the mainstream media because it's not giving people the truth. And so that plus the experience of COVID, which has opened so many people's eyes to the insidious relationship between the pharmaceutical companies and government agencies and the profit over people motives, that people are listening, and I think it's going to have a huge audience.
Well, I know I saw Vaxxed, and I feel like a lot of people talked about that. I saw it back in 2016. Some friends actually were like, hey, you got to come over, you got to watch this film. And I was already very anti-vaccination, just personally. That was kind of my own personal beliefs at the time. And so I was definitely interested in the film, really enjoyed the film. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to me to see someone who has a medical background and you are a doctor. Now, this is, what number film is this, like number three or something?
No, this is number six.
Oh, number six. Now you're a filmmaker. How do you make that transition? I'm kind of interested, like, because that's not typical, right? Someone is a physician to make the transition into maybe a documentary film or filmmaker. How do you make that transition?
Well, it's a very good question, and I get asked this a lot. You know, what they did, because of the stance I'd taken, and people have learned this through COVID, what happens to doctors and scientists who stand up to the system, who challenge the stock price of the pharmaceutical companies, then there is no mercy. And that's what happened to me. I had my license taken away, and I came to America as a professional and political exile, and continued the work in this great country. And eventually they managed to shut me down. They are very, very powerful, and there is no price you will not pay for taking against them. And it was a very different world in those days. This cancel culture was virtually unknown, and it really has exploded in the face of COVID. But I had to go on serving these children somehow, and I wanted to know how to do it. And I sort of asked myself, and I had these stories from whistleblowers, and I thought, you know what? I love film. I've time to turn them into movies. And I started screenwriting in 2004. I started, taking director's courses, reading everything I could read. I sort of applied my academic training to the study of filmmaking and got more and more into it. And this was my first full-length feature film, you know, based upon a screenplay. In fact, I wrote the screenplay with Terry Rossio, and people say, who's Terry Rossio? But Terry Rossio wrote little-known films like Shrek and Pirates of the Caribbean, Aladdin, yeah. Godzilla versus King Kong, and things like this. So a man at the top of his game and a great friend, and we made this, and we filmed it. It was a wonderful experience. I enjoyed it enormously. It was the essence of collaboration and a sort of mutual goal. It was fantastic, and some wonderful actors. So there's no going back. I think I love feature films now, and will continue to make them. So that's really how it came about.
Yeah, I want to pull up the IMDb, I think, on the screen while we're sitting here and looking at it. But you definitely, this new film, it's kind of like a drama based on true events, if I'm describing it accurately. But it's got some pretty big name actors in it. I was looking, and I recognized immediately, and I don't know exactly what his character is, maybe a CEO or a major manager of Merck, I'm assuming, but Eric Roberts is a pretty famous actor. Always that villain character.
He's a good villain. He's
I'm kind of interested, like, when it comes to, you know, this film and everything, is it your partner that's kind of, you know, spearheading this and bringing a lot of these actors? Are you working with them, or are you on set? Like, what does that look like?
Well, no. So we sat down and we decided, right, who do we need? Now, I'd written the characters, and I had a sense of who I wanted. And among them were, as you say, established actors like Matthew Marsden from Rambo and Black Hawk Down and Eric Roberts. And then there were some new discoveries, and I want to mention just two of those. And one was Rachel Whittle. And Rachel is in Louisiana, and she came to me through one of my producers, Joey Vasatka, my two wonderful producers on the show. And she had done some small parts previously, and we got, in response to our casting, we got 2,500 young women responded saying, we'd like to send in reels of the particular scenes we'd sent them. And it was very tricky. I mean, 2,500, in some of them cases, very, very good actors. And she stood out head and shoulders above the others. Absolutely extraordinary, her preparation, her everything about her. And so she is someone to really watch out for in the future. And the other one is a young chap who plays the sort of whipping boy at Merck, Harrison Tipping, who is an English stage actor who came to this as his first movie, and again gives an excellent performance. So it was a joy working with them, and they made my life very, very easy. And we have a, dare I say it, a great film. I really mean that, and I don't say that lightly. And we just in the last week have won 17 film awards. So we're very, very pleased with that. Things are going very well.
And it's based on a true story. I know you mentioned at some point about the legal battle. Is that still ongoing? What is the status?
Okay, so it is, well.
So the film is actually still alive and well, in a sense. So I guess the film's kind of covering the first part of this journey and the story, but we're going to have to continue living it.
Well, there is the opportunity for a sequel, but not least of which, we tell a complete story. We tell the story that in some ways should play out.
Right.
If this case is filed under the False Claims Act, where the government has been defrauded, the CDC purchases this defective vaccine, knowingly defective vaccine, for its children, vaccines for children's program. So the government has been defrauded by, that is the allegation, by Merck. However, the problem is this, that for political reasons, I'm quite sure, in order to not cast aspersions upon the safety of vaccines and put the public off and all kinds of reasons, profit among them, the judge and Merck didn't defend in any way, in any material way, the allegations of fraud. They said the CDC continued, or the government continued to purchase this vaccines, therefore it wasn't relevant. We could have, if the government really felt strongly about this fraud, then they could have done something about it. They could have stopped purchasing the vaccine. In other words, the fraud is not material. And so this issue of materiality is what the judge ruled on. Yes, there was fraud. Yes, Merck did all these things, in my opinion, but it wasn't material because the government went on buying it. Now, the government turned around and said, no, we had no choice. You've bundled these things up into measles, mumps, rubella, and we need to give children vaccines against measles and rubella, and we have no other source. So you've got us with our hands tied behind our back. We've got to buy your vaccine, despite the fact that the mumps component may be defective, is defective. And so, but the judge didn't buy into that, and so now it's gone to appeal, and that will play out, I think, towards the end of June. And then it may well go on either to have the case continued and go to jury trial, which it won't do. But all of this made me realize how important the film was, because here was the possibility, the very strong possibility, that for political reasons, Merck could get off the hook. They could get away with this. They could [S2] Right. [S1] Get away with this outrageous behavior. And I cannot allow that to happen, knowing what I know and knowing how it's affecting people out there across this country. That can't be allowed to happen. And so the story must be told, whatever the consequences for us.
Well, it looks really gripping. I want to play the trailer here for a minute and get everybody to kind of have a sample here, and then we can kind of talk about it a little bit more. But, you know, I definitely think it's really important to get the information out there and to talk about it. And I think that, you know, court cases like this, legal battles like this, help some people recognize this is a real battle. It's not just, you know, somebody just giving their random opinion or something, but rather there is real life implications. There are people fighting this. And so let's go ahead and play this trailer here for Protocol 7. Give them just a second. I want to play the trailer from, I think it's from IMDb. They have the movie. It's just a couple minutes. Go ahead and play it if you can. I don't think
smart,
we can hear it.
Bright.
Oh, there we go.
Then we got him home and he crashed right in front of us.
Apparently, we're in the midst of a mumps outbreak.
Another?
Some very important people are saying our vaccine does not work.
You're gonna want to read this. We have a U.S. monopoly and a major share of the world market for MMR. And we own the only one that works.
Except that it does not.
We all sign contracts, Chuck. Company interests above all others.
Make it work. They fake the data. It's all there.
They cheated on every level.
You said you're a lawyer.
Family law.
And you want to understand why.
Let me see it.
They couldn't get the result they wanted, so they re-engineered it. Not objective to improve the vaccine, but find something that gets them the result they want.
Fix it, gentlemen. 96%.
The vaccine fails, we're all out of a job.
It has failed. You need to get what's going on here.
Is he in danger?
Internal memos were released. Quote, we may have to seek them out and destroy them where they live. Shilly knows. And yes, he is in danger.
What about Ishal?
Your son and every other son and daughter depends on whether or not you choose to live by their rules.
Incineration. Immediately.
Can we trust him to keep it together?
Were you aware?
Some tests included the weakened strain, I believe.
And did you approve?
I guess so.
Were you aware of the lab's failure to demonstrate efficacy of the mumps vaccine, a level required by the FDA?
No, to respond to the FDA's concerns.
And leave a dangerous vaccine on the market.
Dangerous?
Objection.
Strongly recommended booster shots.
Of course you did.
What have they got? Right, nothing's what they got.
Would you please identify this document for us? Please identify Exhibit 2 for me.
They've got stuff.
No, wait.
Exhibit 3, please.
This is a confidential document.
Objection. These were shredded.
It's a protocol.
They've got the sheets. They've got the evidence I was told they didn't have. No one will ever believe them again.
Wow, that was really gripping. You know, it's kind of funny to me because lawsuits in general are not very exciting. They can be really boring, but the film itself is capturing a lot of intense moments, some really good acting looks like there. I'm excited to not only get to find out the information, but even be somewhat entertained while learning about this. Maybe even horrified, I don't know, but how do you feel about the trailer?
I love the trailer. I kind of get goosebumps every time I see it. And you make a very good point, because being a filmmaker, your job is to entertain. Unless you entertain first and foremost, you don't have an audience. If you entertain people and you then tell them a story, factual content, where you get them sitting forward in their seats wanting to know more, then you have an audience. And so we have to make a film that primarily entertains. It has to be factually correct, has to be honest, has to tell a great story, but it must grip people. They must want to know more about the story. So, yeah.
Well, I think it looks great. It looks fantastic. I really enjoyed the Vax film, and it was more of a documentary style from my memory, but this
exactly.
This is a little bit more of a drama, and I'm excited to kind of see how it unfolds and what's going on, getting more information about the legal situation. And, you know, the thing that's hard for some people to realize is this is real people. This is real mothers. This is real children. you know, to lose your medical license is a big deal. I know that, you know, a lot of people want to be doctors. I think in reading your biography, you came from a family of doctors. Isn't that correct? Your yeah. family, your parents were doctors as well?
Six generations.
So to be a doctor was probably a big deal, right?
We all trained at the same medical school, St. Mary's Hospital in London. My brother, cousins, nieces, nephews have all gone into medicine. So it's in our blood, and it was a big deal. But you have a choice. And this is, you come to the crossroads, and the crossroads are, you know, the dean of the medical school said to me, if you continue this vaccine safety research, it will not be good for your career. And that kind of made me angry, made me determined to work twice as hard at it, because what about the children? Hang on, you know, I don't work for the drug companies. I don't work for the government. I work for the person sitting across the desk from me whose life has been destroyed. And so you reach that crossroads, and the decision is, do I work for these people or do I work for this child? That's an easy choice. The consequences are not so easy to deal with, but they're part of what, you know, the decision you've made. And they're part of why you signed up to do this job in the first place. So I, in that respect, have no regrets. And I'm loving the opportunity now to tell these stories in film. And with the help of people like you, getting it out there through alternative media, if you like, is so powerful, so powerful. And one thing I would strongly recommend, I want this film to play in every town in North America that has a movie theater. And we can do that now. We can do this by theatrical on demand. And that means that anyone can go onto the website at protocol7.movie, and you scroll down to host a screening, and you can host a screening. You can, at no cost to you, you say, I want to host a screening. Gather the company, GATHR, will find you a movie theater in your town. And all you've got to do is get people, your friends, your family, your fellow activists, your fellow church members to come to that movie on a particular night. They usually do nights which are sort of low, you know, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, they're not full. So they will sell you the theater or give you the theater. And if you get a certain number of tickets sold to your friends, family, etc., then you tip the theater, you own it for the night, and you can play the movie. The movie will screen. So everyone can have their host their own screening of this across America. So please, please, please go to protocol7.movie and learn how to do it. It's a wonderful way of getting the movie out there. And I want this film to be the kind of success that really meaningful films like Sound of Freedom have been. I think it can do the same kind of thing. And then what that enables us to do is go on and make the next movie.
Right. Yeah, I got to see Sound of Freedom in theaters. It's a great film. And we've even ourselves have hosted a few screenings, private screenings at movie theaters. And I think it's probably a process that a lot of people need to be aware of, just because good films these days, you sometimes have to do it yourself. And you kind of have to get out there and be an activist. And I know on your site here, you've got several theaters that have already kind of signed up, and then there's opportunity for people to do their own screenings. And so highly encourage people to participate in this project, in this film. You know, this topic is definitely near and dear to my heart, because back in 2014, we were pregnant with our first child. And so I actually started doing research on these issues and trying to figure out, you know, what I believed and what I kind of wanted to do. And it seemed pretty clear that, you know, there was a lot of talk about how great, you know, MMR and all these different vaccines are, but they didn't really want to show you the evidence. They didn't really want to talk about any possible negative side effects or any issues. And that was definitely alarming to me, that, you know, if it was such great science, then why don't we have all these double-blind studies? Why aren't we just showing the evidence? Why don't we talk about the adverse reactions? And I even know someone asked a question in here, and we kind of just want to get your perspective, but someone was just kind of genuinely asking, do you think that the MMR vaccine is safe? And just kind of to go beyond that, do you think that all vaccines are safe, or is there, you know, what's kind of your view when it comes to just vaccinations in general?
Well, put aside the issue of pro and anti-vaccine and simply ask yourself a scientific question, and that is, have the definitive safety studies been done which allow you to contend that they are or are not safe? And of course, those would be, those definitive studies are a large, long-term, randomized comparison of children receiving the vaccine with those not receiving the vaccine. And for the childhood vaccines on the schedule, those studies have not been done. Let me give you one example. Hepatitis B vaccine, which is given to infants, one-day-old infants, on the recommendation of the CDC, and the it's really for a disease which is a disease of intravenous drug abusers and the sexually promiscuous. Okay, it is not for children at all.
Right.
The safety studies for that vaccine, how long did they last? How long would you want them to last? Well, you'd want them to last a very, very long time. The safety studies for the Merck product, the Merck hepatitis B vaccine, was 5 days. 5 days. So if your child fell ill on the day six, it was nothing to do with the vaccine. For the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, it was 4 days. This wasn't even done, this study, in children of the appropriate age, not in neonates. It was done in older children, and there were no controls. That is not science. That is not science. And so one cannot say that they are safe and effective based upon the existing science. Irrespective of how I might personally feel about vaccines, as a scientist, that is what I would demand, and that is what is missing.
You know, I'm interested also, there's an article, I want to see if we can get it pulled up, but, you know, I kind of hear this mantra that there's no link between any vaccinations and autism. And, you know, I think that that's primarily a lot of the angst against you is saying that there may be a correlation or that this may have some relation. And some people say that this never been proven and things like that. And, you know, here's an article that's from CBS News, and it's talking specifically about how a family was awarded $1.5 million in a vaccine autism-related injury. And what I found interesting about this specific article is kind of down below. I don't know if you can scroll down. It says, like, read Cheryl Atkinson's 2008 report, but there's a paragraph right below that. It says, in acknowledging Hannah's injuries, the government said vaccines aggravated an unknown mitochondrial disorder Hannah had, which didn't, quote, cause her autism, but, quote, resulted in it. And I just felt like that was interesting wording. It was kind of tricky wording that, okay, this young girl is getting paid by the government for a link to autism due to a vaccine injury. And they say, well, it didn't cause it. It just simply resulted in it. And I guess from a parental perspective, I don't even think that they're hearing that. Do mothers really care whether it causes it or results in it? I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are.
You're absolutely right. This kind of government doublespeak is obscene. It's absolutely ridiculous, and it's an insult to the intelligence of parents. It really is. I mean, firstly, this is not a mitochondrial defect. It is a conserved genetic variant that at some stage conferred an advantage. It's not a defect at all. It's just that some people have this particular genetic makeup, others have a different. Does that put them at risk of reacting badly to a vaccine? So that would be the natural course of the science that should have flowed from this. What should have happened is the CDC should have commissioned the definitive science to answer this question. They didn't. They ran as far away as fast as they possibly could.
Well, and, you know, again, some people are just unaware that there's programs like VAERS. There's other ways in which vaccine injuries are reported. And I think that VAERS actually got a little bit of attention due to COVID because a lot of people heard about it since then. Now, I actually had written I think I told them to go to the wrong. I had actually preached a couple sermons on this, but I also want to go to somewhere else. Go to the godresource.com article. See if you can get that pulled up. Yeah, scroll down and go to the citations. So I wrote an article about vaccination in 2015, and I had put some research in here. And one of the things that I found kind of – so click on that citations button. Yeah, so scroll down a little bit, probably like number four. It's a little bit further. Yeah, right about there. And I don't know if we can pull up that chart a little bit cleaner, verse number six. Actually, if you just click the link, yeah, click that bottom one, not the, yeah, the bottom right there. The very bottom, yep, exactly. And then scroll down a little bit to the first chart. So if you look at this specific chart, it actually talks about the infant mortality rate in developed nations. And America is actually 32nd on this list, I believe. If we scroll all the way down a little bit, what is the number there? It's fuzzy for me, but it's pretty much at the bottom. Almost, you know, several other developed nations have a much better infant mortality rate. And in this same article, if you scroll down a little bit further, yeah, see if you can scroll down to the next. Yeah, so the United States was 34 in this particular list at 6.2. Scroll down a little bit further in this article if you can. And I think that it has, yes, the number of doses for these particular countries as well, or the number of vaccines that they would receive as a requirement. And you kind of notice a pattern, and it's a loose pattern, but albeit the developed countries that have the lowest infant mortality rates also seem to have, generally speaking, the lowest number of required vaccinations. Now, again, maybe that's just a complete coincidence, but at the same time, to me, you know, it could be related as well. And it doesn't seem like anybody's bringing this up about how the infant mortality rate's higher in the United States, and we have a higher number. I think we might even have the highest number of required vaccinations for children two and under. I just found that this information was kind of was interesting, to say the least. I don't know. Have you seen any kind of data on this, or is this something you've ever kind of looked into as far as the infant mortality rate and considering like the number of doses of vaccination that children receive?
Yes, my focus has been largely on childhood developmental disorders, but exactly the same applies for infant mortality rates. Adverse outcomes across the board have this correlation to vaccine doses. Now, that doesn't mean causation, but what it should light a fire under the regulators to establish whether or not correlation and causation do lead us to cause or not, if only to put the public's mind at rest, but they haven't. And when they lie, as they did lie in Vaxxed, it takes on a whole new meaning, because as a student of human behavior, what I look at is, do I trust this person or not? Do I believe what this patient is telling me or not? And when you see someone lie, it's a visceral reaction. It's not a cerebral reaction. You look at them and you know instinctively that they are not being honest with you, or on the contrary, I can trust this person. And I've watched them lie. And it's when people need to lie, they've got something to hide. And they've certainly got something to hide. And that I find even perhaps more persuasive than the positive evidence is their need to lie, which is what they did with the MMR autism study that was featured in Vaxxed. So I have grave misgivings about this in terms of safety and efficacy. And the deeper you dig, the worse it gets. And this is something that, you know, people like Bobby Kennedy found when he first got involved in this. He just couldn't let it go because it was so compelling, this link between neurodevelopmental disorders and vaccines. And so we will get an answer to it. We will, but we have to force the issue. And what we must never do is make decisions based in fear. So with this film, we put it out so Merck come after us. Well, they don't. But if they do, that's just the price we pay for telling the truth. And but we must never, ever make decisions based in fear.
Well, I like that advice. And, you know, again, when it comes to this topic, I feel like the truth fears no investigation. You know, some people might ask or question, like, why would they lie about this stuff? Or, you know, what's the incentive to hurt children? And I don't think that anybody genuinely wants to hurt children. I don't believe that at all. But I do think that there's a monetary issue here that kind of clouds the waters. And whenever when I was doing some of my research, I noticed that when it comes to political lobbying, a lot of these pharmaceutical companies are giving large sums of income to lobbying specifically. And this is public information. I think I have a chart. I want to see if we can get it pulled up. In 2010, and again, I wrote this article in 2015, so the data is kind of around the timeline. But in 2010, in quarter one, health lobbying, it's this public record information. You can see which companies gave to political, you know, individuals, such as you see Pfizer giving $4 million. You see Merck giving $3.2 million. You see GlaxoSmithKline giving $2 million of political lobbying in 2010. And then if you scroll down a little bit, in 2011, then the government also issued publicly available information, contracts to companies as far as the manufacturing. And you'll notice the same, virtually the same kind of companies. GlaxoSmith is awarded a $786 million contract. Merck is awarded a $1.7 billion contract. Pfizer's given a $1.6 billion contract. And again, you know, you could just say that's coincidence again, or that's just interesting. But there's big bucks. And this is numbers from 2011. I can't even imagine what the numbers and the contracts are for COVID or for some of these other potential health contracts. So there's a lot of money. If it was found out that these manufacturers are doing something dishonest, insincere, or causing harm when they shouldn't, I mean, this is going to cost a lot of money to certain individuals. Isn't that not true?
Exactly right. I think that there is a huge amount of money at stake. And in fact, in this particular case, Merck were faced with a dilemma. They had a vaccine that didn't work, the mumps vaccine, and they could either say, right, we're going to pull this from the market. We're going to go and develop a new mumps vaccine that is safe and effective, and we're going to prove it during doing the appropriate science. Or the alternative is we're going to just change the numbers. We're going to fake the data in a way that give us the result that enable us to convince the FDA to renew our license or protect our license. And our US monopoly will continue and we'll make a lot of money. And so that commercial expedient was what in fact, you know, dictated their actions at the end of the day. And they did the wrong thing. They did the wrong thing. And why is this important? You may say, well, what if a vaccine doesn't work, how does that make it dangerous? And the problem with mumps is this, that mumps in children is a trivial disease. That's widely acknowledged. Mumps in post-pubertal young students, young adults, is not a trivial disease. It can cause testicular inflammation and sterility, or ovarian inflammation or meningitis at a much higher rate than meningitis than in children. So if you have a vaccine that only works for a limited amount of time or not at all, then you make people susceptible to mumps again when they're older, when it's a more dangerous disease. So a vaccine that doesn't work makes mumps a more dangerous disease. And Merck knew this, and yet they continued. So safety and efficacy, protectiveness, are inextricably linked in the context of mumps. And this is why a theme that is brought out in the film very clearly, so that people understand that.
And that's basically because contracting the disease and building natural immunity is different than the theory behind why vaccinations give protection. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. And we know that with these infections, like measles, mumps, one exposure to the natural infection as a child leads to protection for life. You are protected from that disease for life. That is natural immunity. When the vaccines were introduced, we were promised that it would be the same. It would be the same as natural immunity, but it wasn't, of course. Why? Well, not least of which is because these are respiratory viruses. Measles is a respiratory virus. Suddenly we're changing the whole course of nature and man's interaction with this virus by injecting it into the skin, bypassing an immune system in the lungs that's been set up specifically to protect us against this virus. So why are we surprised that it doesn't give the same kind of immunity? Why are we surprised? And then we're giving not one virus, but three viruses at the same time in a way that the immune system has never seen it. It's never seen measles, mumps and rubella immediately at the same time, and it's not going to respond in the same way. But there have been so many assumptions by the authorities about these live viral agents, which are exquisitely adapted to survive and, you know, mutate and change and come back in some other form. And one thing that this will teach us is that nature is all powerful. And if we think we can get the upper hand and exploit these viruses, then we have a real lesson to learn. And if we didn't learn it with COVID, then we're in big trouble.
Well, and specifically, you know, I can think of how my mom would tell me that she would, when I was a two, she made me go to a pox party, is what they would call them. And I know that's not necessarily the MMR, but we're talking about chickenpox specifically. But yep. The idea was that exposure at a young age was less severe and I would have lifetime immunity. And so she was like purposely getting me sick. And of course, I don't remember at 2 years old. I have no idea. You know, I just have to trust that my mother was telling me the truth. But I'm sure, you know, of course she wouldn't just make up a story like that. But of course, there was an idea, especially back then, that, you know, you go ahead and if anybody has a chicken pox, get all the toddlers and make them play with them. And so they'll contract this disease. And I think that kind of is a similar belief or kind of what you're describing here, that perhaps contracting some of these diseases or issues as a baby may actually be better in the long term of a particular individual. Is that, am I kind of describing that accurately?
Very much. And I remember chickenpox, measles parties. Yes. Can we go back? You showed a graph in the paper that you'd written. There was a graph of declining mortality in the United States.
Well, show the vaccine one first, because I think this is an important point. And what's interesting to me is whenever I looked up research that's like the pro-vaccine, like their articles, this is typically what they would show. And they would show something like, see, here's vaccination has helped reduce global cases of mumps, measles, and rubella. And there's a lot of different articles like this. In fact, if you go, there was another one I had that was like the immunize.org. I believe they have a chart, and it shows how after vaccination, everything's reduced 99 percentile. I think it's the first link in that article that I had written in the back, if you can go to it. But you see a conglomerate of posters like this. Yeah, go all the way to the top and then click on that.
This one. That's the one I want to, because yeah, this is such an important.
So they show 99% reduction in all of these specific diseases. And they talk about how from 1960 to now, if we focus and highlight just one specific situation, which we talk about measles or something like that, they would say measles, you know, it was 1963, the vaccine was introduced, and they'll say, oh, we've had a 99% reduction. Now go to that chart that Dr. Wakefield was mentioning, because I think this is an important point. You know, if you look at this chart, if you look at this information, it sounds good, right? Like, hey, there's been a 99% reduction. But then if you roll back the clock and you look, this is from the 1900 all the way to 1984, and they show the measles vaccine introduced. Well, the mortality rate specifically doesn't seem affected by the vaccine directly. It seems like it's arbitrary, like an arbitrary line. We could just say Woodstock happened in 1963, and it just seems as related. But I do want to get your opinion, like on a chart like this. You know, you're a medical doctor. You're someone that studied this stuff. What is this? You know, what are the conclusions you draw from this?
This is a fascinating graph, okay? But this is the kind of data when measles was widely recognized for what it was. In other words, doctors were able to diagnose it. And so we can trust the credibility of this data as being unbiased. Now, you would see the same trend in any developed Western country. The same graph pertains to the United Kingdom. Now, what this shows is mortality from measles over time. Before the vaccine ever came in, you can see the effect of the vaccine when it did come in. This is absolutely fascinating, because what this shows is that over time, naturally, measles was killing fewer and fewer and fewer children. It was becoming a milder and milder and milder disease. Now, what would have happened? Here's the first question a scientist would ask, is what would have happened if we'd never introduced the vaccine?
Right.
Would this trend have simply decayed to zero? Would measles become so mild, as it was doing, that we wouldn't see any mortality from measles? So forget number of measles cases, measles still occurred, but it was no more than a cold, no more than a cold in children. That's what was happening here. That's what this graph is telling. But we had to interfere. We had to intervene. We've got the technology. We can make money out of it, whatever the motive. And so they interfere with the vaccine, and then they show you a graph of measles cases. What
right.
this shows right. is the effect of natural herd immunity. This decay in mortality, measles becoming less and less severe, a milder and milder disease, is natural immunity. And that was the kind of thing that was perpetuated by the reasons for this are detailed. They are in part because of a general improvement in immunity due to sanitation and fresh water, and in part due to the pattern of exposure to the virus. This is because more and more children were being exposed to the virus when, for example, they went to school, when they were young, when they were able to deal with the virus in a particular way. And this has now changed. And it's changed because we've shifted the age of measles. So when measles does come back now, it affects older people whose immunity has waned because the vaccine wore off, and babies who historically, under the age of one, were protected by maternal immunity. Their mothers who had had natural measles gave them very good immunity. Mothers who have been vaccinated against measles do not give their babies good immunity. So under the age of one, babies born now are not protected against measles. And that is a very precarious situation because that's where mortality is greatest. So vaccination has destroyed natural herd immunity. And here is the effect of natural herd immunity in that graph. That is an extraordinary powerful effect of nature. And because we thought we should interfere and did, we've messed that whole thing up. And that, so people really need to understand the history of measles, as you point out, to really gauge what has gone on here.
Well, and of course, you know, you bring up the idea that sanitation improved, overall cleanliness, hospital standards, just the habits of people have changed over time. And I know that none of those are the reason why measles dropped, because you can't make money on any of those ideas. And so it definitely had to be the vaccine, because that's the only way you can make money. But, you know, when it comes to this information, it's not shareable. I mean, I preached a sermon on this in 2018 called Vaccination Snake Oil. And I, you know, I kind of brought up things like this point and that chart and that graph, and it was censored. And, you know, it was one of the first things that was kind of censored on YouTube. Censorship really hadn't taken off at that time. And it's interesting to me because, you know, predating that is what you mentioned, how Robert De Niro had a hand in kind of getting your film removed from a particular film festival talking about this issue. And it does seem like the censorship works, because I know family members, friends, you know, whenever I said, you know, I'm kind of skeptical of some of these things. I don't know that I want my children to be vaccinated necessarily. And I was looked at as being, you know, a crazy person, very ill-informed, anti-science, anti-history. And I'm trying to talk to these people. I'm saying, I feel like I was using science and history to come to the conclusion I did. I wasn't rejecting science and history. I was rather trying to use those to combat that theory. Because in my mind, if someone knocked on my door and said, I have this magic potion that's going to protect your children, can we inject it into them? You know, you would have to really have a lot of evidence on your side to try and convince me that that was necessary. And especially considering from a historical perspective, you know, it's not like vaccination has been from the last 1,000 years. This is a more relatively new phenomenon in health. And so it's not natural. It's not something that everybody just does naturally. It's something that is done through the medium of pediatricians and these other institutions. And, you know, what's interesting to me is when I talked to my pediatrician about this, they said, we're going to drop you as a client. They said, if you don't do the vaccination schedule as dictated, we will drop you as a client. And so they literally dropped us. And I found out that anywhere from 40 to 60% of income of pediatricians is attributed directly to vaccination. And so, you know, it definitely, there's a lot of resistance to questioning these things, just wanting to know what's going on and not wanting to just fall, you know, in their footsteps. And I know there's a lot of fear. My wife, especially, there was a lot of fear put on her, like your children's going to die. Your child's going to die immediately if you don't get these vaccinations, or you're not going to be able to participate in normal life and go to public school and be a part of government programs, and people are going to think you're weird. And, you know, a lot of that didn't necessarily affect me, but it affected my wife. And I think it affects a lot of people when we talk about the social stigma. And for you specifically, it seems like when pressure was put on you, you kind of just said, well, I'm going to research this even harder. Can you kind of talk to the social stigma here? And maybe like the feeling that mothers have when it comes to these issues?
I can, and I'm so grateful that you brought it up, because the other part of this film is the arc of the story of the heroine, a mother who cannot have children for one reason or another, and adopts a child who is then subsequently vaccine injured. And this mother is the amalgam, if you like, the agglomeration of all of the mothers I've spoken to, the thousands of mothers I've spoken to over the last 30 years. And so many of them have said, I just knew when I went in and I did this and the doctor took them away or the nurse took them away, I knew in my gut that this was wrong. And that, the power of that maternal intuition is extraordinary. And it's been a guiding light in my medical practice to listen to mothers, because mothers know their children unlike anyone else. And the pediatricians have tried to usurp this more so, I think, in America than in the UK, but most certainly tried to usurp that power and say, no, you don't understand your child as well as I do, even though I've never met them before or met them once. It's absolute nonsense. The hubris, the arrogance of that is extraordinary. And so here we have this relationship which has been forged over millions of years of evolution, of this mother-maternal child bond. Mothers know their children. And so when they say, I took my child to be vaccinated, I just felt at the time this was wrong, and this has happened as a consequence of that, I believe they're related, then I take that extremely seriously. And the part played by the mother in this film really exemplifies that. She faces conflict for every single thing she does by the kind of pushback that you've had. Pushback from the doctor, pushback from the pediatrician, pushback from the psychologist or psychiatrist, pushback from her own mother, pushback from her husband in particular, who dismisses, as often is the case in real life, the mother's instinct, does not appreciate the power of that instinct. So one of the key messages of this film is for mothers to seize that power back, really to trust in it, to trust in that small voice that is saying to you, do this or don't do this, because you know best. Now, why is this? And you can invoke God, you can invoke this extraordinary bond that they have, because they were once one. They were once one body, and they will be inseparable forever. But it is nonetheless as real as I am talking to you. And it's been such a powerful influence on my medical practice. And I tried to do credit to that, to honor that in this film. And so that's my message to mothers out there. You regain that power. You seize that power back. You keep it because it's yours. And it does not belong to doctors. And it is up to doctors to be sufficiently humbled to listen to that and to take note of it and to act accordingly.
Well, I agree. wholeheartedly that mothers, you know, have a special intuition about their children. And I think a lot of it comes from love. And I think that if we can have mothers just love their children enough, they can face all kinds of foes. Like you mentioned, I think that's a powerful part of this film. The idea that a mother is kind of seeing many people come against her, whether that be internally, externally, because sometimes, especially on a journey like this in our current culture, there's a lot of resistance. I know with COVID, there was a lot of internal conflict between families on, you know, vaccination or not, or how to treat that particular illness. And to me, timing sometimes is everything, and especially with a film. And I think that it seems like with COVID specifically, a lot of people have kind of awoken to the idea that maybe anti-vaxxers aren't as weird and horrible as Wikipedia makes them out to be, and that maybe there is something to this. And so I find that the timing of this film seems like a great opportunity to come on the heels of a lot of skepticism, to come alongside with a reasoned approach and say, yeah, there is something to, you know, these internal instincts. You know, for me, probably the most influential thing for me when it came to making this decision is in the Bible, Jesus said, "They that be whole need not a physician." And I really took those words to heart, and I thought, you know, if my baby's whole, it just doesn't feel right to just purposely give them several different diseases. You know, if they come into in contact naturally, then so be it. You know, I'm not going to put my kid in a plastic suit bubble and hide them from the world. But at the same time, I don't know that I have to purposefully give them any kind of disease or illness and just hope for the best. And so, you know, to me, that verse was a guiding light. And, you know, I really think that there's a lot of people kind of waking up to some of the issues here. Do you feel like the timing of this film may have been purposeful, or is it just kind of, it just works for you guys? Or, you know, can you speak to the timing of this film and just kind of what's going on in the culture right now?
Well, I think so many things have happened in my life that have been taking me in this direction. It would be naive and premature to assume that they were not purposeful in some way. I think that the timing is extraordinary, particularly coming on the back of COVID. And I think COVID would turn out to be one of the biggest mistakes they ever made in terms of the lies, the distortion, and the consequences, the extraordinary number of deaths that came about because they denied people safe and effective treatments, because they wanted a vaccine and vaccine only agenda. It had to succeed, and therefore they were prepared to lose a lot of people along the way in order to, you know, essentially profit. And that's tragic. And also what they said about the vaccine, it continues to unravel. None of the promises that were made have been kept. They were naive to have ever made them because they had no understanding really of what they were doing. So people are ready for this kind of film. It's not just, I know Peter McCullough, who is one of the great stalwarts, a very brave, brave physician, over 700 publications as a cardiologist, and who has come to the understanding through science that vaccines are not safe. Firstly, he thought it was the COVID shot. Now he knows it goes beyond that. That listening to someone like Peter McCullough, who the system has systematically tried to destroy as a consequence of the position he's taken, because it's so powerful, because it represents science, because that's undeniable. He's published far more than all his critics. When that happens, then the world comes to a point where it says, okay, you know, I know Peter McCullough, I've read his papers. If he says this is the case, then there's a case to be answered here. And I think that that is happening, and it is reinforced by this kind of film. So I think timing is extraordinary for this. It is very fortuitous, but we need to capitalize on it. We need to, what I mean by that is we need to seize this opportunity to get people to watch the film. Don't stand by and just passively say, oh, if it comes to a theater near me, then maybe I'll go and watch it, or I'll wait till it streams on television. No. Get to the movie theater, hire the movie theater through Gather, through the website. Go to protocol7.movie, and please, please, please make sure that every town in America screens this movie and gives people the opportunity to see it and make up their own minds.
Yeah, and we want to share the information even beyond the film and, you know, continue to get it out there. I know I saw a film called Died Suddenly that also talked about some of the issues with specifically the COVID shots. And I think that the COVID shots are kind of unique in the sense that they have a little bit different methodology as far as how they're structured. Because I believe the MMR is giving a form of the virus, as it were.
Yeah, it's a live virus, yeah.
Whereas the COVID vaccines were even more unique in their methodology. Can you speak to kind of what's going on with the COVID vaccination and maybe its new methodology as far as trying to create spike proteins artificially?
Yes, it's not a vaccine at all, into our understanding of what a vaccine is. It's a way, it's a gene therapy. So it's injecting the RNA that encodes for a protein, the spike protein, into our own cells, such that our own cells become a factory for the manufacture of the spike protein, which is in itself highly, highly dangerous protein, highly reactogenic protein. And so we now make an immune response against our own cells. Well, that is called an autoimmune disease.
Right.
Isn't it extraordinary that we are actually forcibly encouraging our own bodies to turn against themselves and create this autoimmune disease situation? That is what it is. It's as simple as that. Although it's far more complicated, but it's far more dangerous than that. But that, in essence, is what we're talking about here. We're turning our own cells into factories for viral proteins, which are highly toxic, such that we now attack our own cells. And that's never been done before in the form of a vaccine. It may be because the live viral vaccines are failing that we're going to see suddenly mRNA-based shots being put on the market for measles, mumps, and rubella. And literally, that would be, I was going to say something quite strong then, but that would be catastrophic. That would be disastrous. It's already been proven to be disastrous for many people in the context of COVID. And yet the advocates still maintain that, oh, it's been, the rollout has been such a tremendous success. No, it hasn't. So, that's really what the difference between the live viral vaccine, which is giving an attenuated or modified, a so-called weakened, I don't believe it's weakened, it's just changed, strain of a naturally occurring virus to individuals, as opposed to giving this new COVID shot.
Well, and you kind of have to wonder when it comes to mRNA technology specifically, you know, how do they get that balance perfect to where it's not either creating too many spike proteins or the immune system isn't attacking it too much? Like, how do you get at that perfect balance? And, you know, in theory, some of these things sound okay, right? Obviously, if someone could get injected with something that's going to mimic a virus and then you create the immune response and that causes you to never catch the disease, it sounds great. I just think that the problem is, does that really happen? And what are the side effects? And when it comes to, you know, some of these other vaccination processes, the MMR, they were kind of maybe more of a lifetime. Some of them have a booster, but they're mostly just kind of a lifetime. Whereas it seems like with these COVID vaccinations, you have to get a booster every 6 months. Well, that seems perfect if you need to sell them. It's not necessarily the best when it comes to the general populace, but in a strategy to make money, again, which, you know, the Bible does say the love of money is the root of all evil. You kind of have to ask this question, how safe are these things? And I think this is such an important film, Protocol 7, to talk about, you know, a demonstrated case, still obviously an ongoing legal battle, but a demonstrated case where it appears And there's a lot of evidence to suggest these pharmaceutical companies are willing to lie. They're willing to potentially change data, to do all kinds of different actions to cover up their intentions, the efficacy, the safety of their products. And, you know, I think it's even documented that some of these companies are the most, they've had to pay the most money in lawsuits and doing things inappropriately. So, you know, they don't necessarily have a good reputation. They have no motivation for safety or efficacy. They have legal protections against certain lawsuits towards them. And, you know, these individuals, I don't even think they've taken the Hippocratic Oath. They're not doctors that are trying to necessarily try to get people better or healthy. They're CEOs. They're business owners. They're about making profit. They're about making money. And, you know, when you have actual doctors coming out against it, like Peter McCullough, like you, like others. I know Mercola had at one time been a pretty big advocate in this particular space. There's probably several others, but you know, it's just definitely frustrating to see that so many people are unwilling to even talk about this issue. And so, you know, take your family members, take your friends, say, hey, there's a cool movie that's coming out, Protocol 7. You got to check it out. Even if they don't like this topic, just don't tell them. Just say, hey, come to the movie. We're going to watch an interesting movie, and just let them see for themselves what's going on. And even someone that's not necessarily interested in this topic, it seems like the film's still pretty interesting and engaging anyways, right?
Yeah, if you enjoyed Erin Brockovich, if you enjoyed Silent Spring or Spotlight, this is a movie for you. People love whistleblower movies. So irrespective of, you know, the message that underlies it, it's a great movie, so please.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I don't want to, you're really gracious to give us over an hour of your time, and I did want to give you one last chance here if there's anything else that you wanted to bring up or anything else you wanted to plug for our audience, but I'm really excited about the project. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to showcase it. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up before we kind of let you go?
Oh, this movie was made for you. It was made, it doesn't beat you over the head. It is made to entertain and inform and allow you to make choices and decisions accordingly. But it is based upon fact. It is based upon the actual documents that were part of what happened at Merck. And we are very confident that it will do very well. Whether it does well or not, in large part, comes down to you and spreading the word. Spreading the word and getting people to come and see the movie. So please help us with that, and that will enable us to make the next story.
Someone wanted me to ask this question real quick. For further study, or if they're just interested in this topic, is there any resources, may there be books or websites that people could find more information about this topic?
There is an abundance, and if you enjoy film, then please go and see Vaxxed, because it's very informative, and go and see 1986, The Act, or download that online, and that will be available on our website as well. So we're just preparing that at the moment. But 1986 gives you, The Act gives you the sort of definitive history of how the drug companies, the vaccine manufacturers, came to be exempt from liability for death and injury, such that they had a mandatory market, children had to get their vaccines, no liability, all they could do was make a massive profit. And that's what they did. And that's when they expanded the vaccine program, because they knew they could sell without any liability. So watch those two, and those will direct you to further resources that allow you to go further into this.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. You can check out the movie Protocol 7. You can check it out. In fact, the trailer's on YouTube. It's on IMDb. You can go to their website and you can check out the film. I'm excited to see the film. I think I get to see it June 7th. There's a screening in Texas that I'm going to go see. And so I'm excited for that. And I really appreciate you indulging me to talk about this subject, because so few people in my life are willing to even have a conversation on this topic. And so you inspire me. You also, you know, make a difference in people's lives. No matter how popular the film is, you know, we're still here to reach the individual, And I know there's a lot of individuals who have been positively affected by your stand and others who are willing to, you know, lose their medical license, lose their career, and become a filmmaker. And so we really appreciate you. And that's going to pretty much do it for us on the show. This is a special episode of The Baptist Bias. But make sure to check us out Tuesdays at 8 p.m. when we have our normal show. This week, we're going to have a special debate. You don't want to miss it, but I want you to make sure you check out this film, Protocol 7. And everyone's got a perspective out there, folks, but you need to get The Baptist Bias.